different materials. If the material is pure, it'll be a narrower bandwidth to whatever that frequency range of absorption is going to be. But every material has one. Now, here again, as I said, as that body of whatever material it is starts to absorb. Now, when you talk about a resistor and look at the compound of what the resistor makes up, it's made up of, you're right, it's going to have a pretty darn broad frequency spectrum of heat that comes off of that. And, again, and then depending on if you put surface paint on the top that has a certain specific color, that will be more dominant because it will be the outmost, most visible edge. So we're all kind of on the same page here, but in other words, you're right, it's not necessarily a specific frequency, but as I said, there is a frequency or a range of frequency at which the every material will basically, I hate to use the word resonate, but will, let's say, at the molecular level, vibrate as energy is either, added to it or as it absorbs. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, I'm going to take something you just said and I'm going to challenge you with it. I've got 5 50-ohm resistors on the table in front of me in my example. One of them is made out of carbon. One of them is made out of tungsten. One of them is made out of metal film. One of them is wire wound. I got 5 different resistors. And at my particular frequency, I've wound them skillfully enough so that there's no extra reactance, inductance. They are pure 50-ohm resistors. But I've got 5 different materials that I've used to make a 50-ohm pure resistor at my frequency, 50 megacycles. The materials are different. I've got them all at the exact same temperature. I start measuring the radio noise power at 50 megacycles coming out of those resistors. Will I measure a difference because they are different materials? Over to you, Glenn.
No, I don't believe so. Not at that frequency range, but I think when you start getting into the FIR area, that you'll start to see a peak-up difference, and you will be able to determine the difference in the materials. So there is a point in frequency at which you will see, because there it is going to be broad in certain areas, but there will be a peak-up point that will tell you what the material is. As a matter of fact, that this whole idea and concept of measuring light wavelength actually tells scientists today with telescopes, when they're viewing certain areas of galaxies, what the galaxies consist of, if there's, plasma of the materials, and what's going on out there just because of the color and the wavelength of the light. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm agreeing with that one. The absorptivity-emissivity ratio curves is different for different materials when you get into infrared, optical, ultraviolet, and so on frequencies, yes. Aluminum certainly looks different than gold, even though they're at the exact same physical temperature. I'm going to give you that one. So each material of that very short wavelength has different emissivity curves. I think you were calling that resonance. I'm having trouble with that word. And yes, there are very specific, very short wavelengths at which I can excite those materials. And I may be able to get laser action out of some of those materials if I excite them at exactly the right wavelength, which you could say is the right energy per photon, so that that molecule, let's call it, resonates properly, impedance coupled, and that's what the pumping action of a laser does. And so, yes, I'm now pumping those particular molecules to an excited state, to a higher energy state as far as their outer orbital molecule electrons are concerned, and when they jump down, back down, they put out an extremely specific wavelength. That's what a laser does. But down at our radio frequencies, I don't think any of that happens. My thermometer is primarily measuring much lower frequency phenomena. My oven doesn't do that. The oven in my kitchen only speeds up those air molecules, only speeds up the vibration of the molecules that are in that chicken that I'm heating. I'm not changing the orbits of those electrons, of those molecules in that chicken, in that oven, that convection oven in my kitchen. That's what I believe, and I think you and I have got a difference of opinion on this one, Glenn. Over to you, K2RIW.
Might Fraunhofer want an example?
I'm agreeing to a certain level. I think we're a little bit closer now to where we were last week. But let me offer this as a suggestion. If you have, at the molecular level, you're going to have energy transfer. You have to look at the, you know, granted. Now, in a microwave oven, let me say, separate from a regular oven, let's talk about that one first. At the frequency at which a microwave is tuned, which is, you know, somewhere like around 2.45 gigahertz, somewhere in that area, that's optimized for water polarization. So in other words, what it wants to do is basically that frequency absorbs very nicely into the water molecule, and it will actually change the polarity of the water. But when the polarity is shifting of the water molecules from plus to minus, what's actually going on there? That's got to be something at the electron level state. In other words, it's shifting it so that the molecule's position and its direction of ionization is changing. So it's actually shifting across the whole molecule. Now, the water molecule itself still may be balanced, but what's happening is you're shifting it from one polarity to the next at 2.45, and a lot of energy is being absorbed, thus the temperature is increasing. That's one way of looking at microwave heating at the molecular level. Let me let it drop for a second.
You got a problem here.
Well, then let's take that first.
When Percy Spencer at Raytheon made the first microwave oven, which he called a radar range, he did it at 900 megacycles. What are you saying now?
Well, here again, it's not the optimum frequency. I mean, here again, as I said, water itself has got a pretty broad range to where it starts absorbing energy. I mean, it'll start absorbing anywhere from like 5 microns to like 15, you know, where you start getting water heating effectively. But yes, you could be at lower frequencies. It's just not going to be as efficient.
How do you define the word efficiency? If I put a kilowatt into my microwave oven at 900 megs, every single joule of that kilowatt will go into that cup of water. If I put 2.45 gigahertz into my microwave oven at a kilowatt, every joule of that energy goes into the water. What does the word efficiency mean?
Okay, I'm not sure that efficiency is really the right word here. What I'm saying is that there's at the frequency at which the self-resonance of the material, which it absorbs, the closer you are to it, the easier the electromagnetic energy will convert to heating energy. And as I said, you know, you can go to lower frequencies, and you can still, you know, transfer, you know, thermal dynamic heat from them. But as I said, you get to a certain area where the frequency is going to be optimum. You know, where it's, where the absorption rate of that molecule is going to be, you know, the best. You go a little bit higher, it'll eventually, you'll get to a point to where increasing frequency, it won't have as good a heating effect. You go lower, the same thing. So there is a band of frequencies at which the water will heat better.
I don't agree. The very first resonance of water is around 21 gigahertz. You and I are not going to run a microwave oven up there. It would be much too expensive. The frequency at which you run a microwave oven is strictly a function of the IFM band, what is it called now? The license-free band. It's just a frequency left over. And it's a convenient frequency where you can make a convenient-sized cavity, which is sealed, so that the RF energy bounces back and forth and gets absorbed by the food. There's no magic frequency to run a microwave oven lower than 21 gigahertz. And by the way, the efficiency is the same, because the energy in that microwave oven, when it's properly designed, it bounces until something absorbs it. So every bit of it's going to be absorbed. It's almost as crazy as these advertisements you see for these home heating units that use quartz glass rods, and they claim that they've done an extremely good design because this electric heater you can put in your living room gives you this nice warm heat, and it runs at 100% efficiency because it's a glass rod. Come on. You put 1,000 watts of heating energy, I don't care if it is gallium arsenide, I don't care if it's tungsten, I don't care if it's copper, no matter what you make the heating element of that heater in your living room, an electric heater, every bit of that dissipation has nowhere else to go except to your room. It runs at 100% efficiency. I could make it out of slush, or I could make it out of quartz rod. Craziness. The microwave oven, the energy bounces around in there until it finally gets absorbed by the food. There is no magic frequency. Any frequency would have worked. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Okay, so what you're suggesting then is that if you were to take a 30 megahertz HF transceiver and couple it into a tuned antenna inside your microwave oven, that that's going to cook the food?
Me and Mel have personally fixed diathermy machines. A diathermy machine, you have these two metal plates you put against the guy's knee, and it heats the water of his body. They run at 27 megacycles. I can heat the water in your body by putting two metal plates with rubber insulation around them to make them safe, with these two great big long leads coming back to the machine called a diathermy machine. This is 1950 technology, by the way. And I put it on your knee, and I will heat up your knee at 27 megacycles. It does a beautiful job. Over to you, Glenn.
What about a cup of water?
Now I'd have to put it into an oven that has the right size for 30 megacycles. It would be a much larger oven. The oven is really a waveguide-like cavity. You want the RF energy in the microwave oven to bounce back and forth until the food finally absorbs it. So could I build a cavity at 30 megacycles? Absolutely. I wouldn't like to live with the size it would be. See, the nice thing about that diathermy machine is that those two plates create an extremely strong E field between the plates. And my knee happens to be there, and I decide to heat up my knee to give my make my arthritis go away with this diathermy machine, and it does a beautiful job. You could, in theory, make a microwave oven, it would be a non-microwave oven, which is now an insulated box, a wooden box if you like, and you put these two metal plates across the chicken and turn on the power. I could cook the chicken with a diathermy machine, but now it's a much less shielded device. It's much more sloppy. There'd be a huge variable as to how each person puts those metal plates across the turkey and whatever. In the case of the microwave oven, as long as you've got a cavity that has enough dimensions in wavelength in X, Y, and Z so that energy bounces back and forth in there very nicely, and I can make a very well-shielded door so that the energy doesn't come squirting out of there, that's the only real limitation. Any other frequency you want to use other than the physical constraints of how you construct the oven and the way you put the energy into the food, any frequency in the world would work. Over to you, Glenn.
Dick, are you saying that if you put a dipole antenna on 10 meters into a box which is 10 meters by 10 meters by 10 meters, it'll cook a chicken?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It'll cook the chicken beautifully. If the energy you're pouring in there is properly impedance matched and it has nowhere else to go, it's going to be absorbed by the chicken. And you, if I can cook my knee at 27 megacycles, I know I can cook your chicken, your kosher chicken, at 27 megs. Over to you, I'm having a little bit of fun with you on this one, Barry. Back to you for a quick comment on that one, Barry.
Okay, and it would work with water as well?
The diathermy machine is heating the water that's in my knee. The water is the thing that's most easily heated because the water molecule is a dipole molecule. A dipole molecule tries to follow the RF energy, whether it be 27 megs or 2.45 gigs. It will follow that RF energy and flip back and forth in phase with the RF energy, but it does it with a phase lag. And you and I already had a quick discussion 2 days ago as to what causes that phase lag and what causes the extra velocity, which you and I call temperature, of those water molecules. If that diathermy machine works so well at 27 megs on my knee, why wouldn't it work on your kosher chicken? Over to you, I'm sorry about the way, I shouldn't be doing this, but over to you, Barry.
Okay, I think that the chicken might be too small for the wavelengths. You know, it's like beyond cutoff. I think it has to be bigger.
And I have additional questions. which is the length of the wave. How then the distribution of waves bouncing from the walls would be made? How do you envision that? How can you describe that?
One thing I seem to remember, if you have an ant in your microwave, it might not be cooked.
Right on.
Who told you the ant doesn't get cooked? First of all, the way the diathermy machine works is you've got two metal plates, and you're making an extremely strong oscillating E-field in between those two plates. You could call that the cavity if you like. It's a rather open air type cavity, but it is a cavity. It has a very concentrated E-field between those two plates. And if it cooks my knee, and it doesn't, and you don't have to worry about the 27 megacycle diathermy machine, about having a fat man, a skinny man, a small child, a baby, I can cook any part of your body with a diathermy machine. I can put those two metal plates, one above and one below your toe, and I can heat your toe. I can cook your knee. I can cook your thigh, your leg, your arm, your hand, whatever part you want that I put between those metal plates. When you and I make a capacitor, by making a very simple capacitor where I have an upper plate, a lower plate, and two leads coming off of it, and a dielectric in between, which could be plastic or it could be air, we don't worry about the wavelength of those plates and whether or not the capacitor is going to work at 27 megs, 1 meg, or 200 megacycles. It's creating a very strong E-field between those plates. To a small degree, I could call that the cavity. Does that make some sense, Barry?
No, it doesn't. Something ain't sitting right here, Dick.
Yeah, Dick, can I mention something here as well?
Barry, are you telling me a diathermy machine does not heat the chunk of material, regardless of its size, within reason, that I put between those two plates? By the way, the plates on the diathermy machine that I fixed a couple of decades ago, each of those plates was about an 8-inch square with great big black thick rubber around them and great big leads coming out of it. So these two metal plates buried into, a third of an inch thickness of black rubber, no matter where you put those two plates across a portion of the body, that created heating. Are you saying the diathermy machine did not heat my knee? Is that what you're saying? Go ahead.
It did heat your knee, but the method that it was using to couple the energy into your knee is different than a cavity. Now, just
happening to you a high ratio that gives you a strong field where the food is, where the cup of water is. All you need is a strong E field at an oscillating frequency. You choose the frequency and make the E field in volts per meter great enough, and you will couple energy into the water. So the E field in volts per meter that I get between those two diathermy plates with my knee in between, or the E-field in volts per meter that I get with the bouncing wave inside of my closed cavity microwave oven, in all cases, you give me the right volts per meter, I'll give you that amount of heating of water. Does that make sense, Barry?
Okay, let's let Glenn pick it up. It does, but I gotta think about it. I don't know why. Something, maybe it'll come to me later, but something ain't sitting right in my head about this.
Now, you're thinking that because the lower frequency is making the water molecules oscillate back and forth at a slightly lower rate, that they're not going to be creating heating anymore. Is that what you're saying?
No. I'm saying that the reason why the microwave oven is working is because the objects that are in it are bigger than a wavelength. I think if they were smaller than a wavelength, this might not work.
Coming. 2450 megacycles is a wavelength of 4.5 inches. If I put a small shot jigger of water inside that microwave oven, are you telling me it's not going to get hot?
I'm not sure. I think I guess it would work, but I don't know, because I have seen objects that appeared to be too small to be cooked in a microwave. I've seen it.
What was the object? Was it a metallic? metallic object.
No. It was no, it wasn't a metallic object. Small pieces of meat, I'm telling you. I don't think they'll get cooked. I think they have to be a little bigger.
You realize that every microwave oven has standing waves. And even though there's a stirring device, it's either a lazy Susan that's rotating your chicken, or there's a metal blade in the top, in a phony ceiling of the microwave oven. Even with that rotating, there are still specific spots in the oven that do not give proper heating. My particular Panasonic microwave oven does a poor job of heating something that's a half inch above the floor. Whatever I put a half inch above the floor, I can put a whole turkey in there, and the portion of the turkey a half inch above the floor does not cook properly until I turn it over. Over to you, Barry.
Okay, so you're saying these ants are not getting cooked because they are being shielded. They're in a spot that those microwaves are not getting to because of the way that oven was designed.
You've got it. It's got hot spots, and it's got spots that are very cold by comparison. It's got a bunch of standing waves in there, and those waves are so damn big, 4.5-inch wavelength. Therefore, peaks and valleys are 2.25 inches apart. There's going to be hot spots and cold spots. Let's see, quarter wavelength is going to be 1 inch and a fraction. Every 1 inch and a fraction, you're going to go from a hot spot to a cold spot. The stirring process and the rotating process helps, but doesn't get it perfect. Wesley, and then Glenn in that order. Go ahead, Wesley.
Very interesting discussion. Last week, you stated, if I remember correctly, that frequency tool that will actually split the water molecules to the gas is about 30 megahertz. Am I wrong in this? Then Eric said that you'll be surprised if I tell you that there is 35 to 40 megahertz. Now, the most of the experimenters with the HHO, they use the frequency between 15 and 35 kilohertz. So, at that point, if there is an indication from Eric of one frequency, indication from number of experimenters of another frequency, and your statement, we would say that the frequency does not matter. What matters is the power and the distribution. Back to you.
The rate at which water gets heated for a given frequency is strictly a function of the loss tangent of the water at that frequency and the E field that you're giving it. If I go to the book called Von Hippel, in which he is a great big large format book in which he takes a whole lot of chemical substances, starting with water and alcohol and everything else, and at all the frequencies you care about, he tells you what is the dielectric constant and what is the loss tangent. Water has an extremely broad frequency range where it has a dielectric constant of 81, and it's got a loss tangent of a very low number, something like 0.01. So no matter what frequency you put into water, from a few hundred kilohertz to at least 10 gigahertz, anywhere in that frequency range, water has close to the same loss tangent, close to the same dielectric constant. Anywhere across that huge frequency region of lots and lots of octaves and decades, you give me the exact same volts per meter, whether it be through the plates of your diathermy machine at 27 megs, or whether it be the microwave oven at 2.4 gigs or at 10 gigs, you give me that E field on that water molecule, and I'll give you almost the exact same amount of heating, and the amount of heating is a function of the loss tangent, and that's well documented. Is anybody disagreeing with that? Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW.
I do agree, but the question is, you didn't say how is the distribution happening? You have a microwave frequency, and then you have a quite long frequency with the kilohertz, extremely long one. Now, how do you say, is it the metal box or is it the wooden box? Of how is the distribution, how is it bouncing out? And the box might be even smaller than the wavelength. I'm just kind of confused in this area.
down to a frequency like 27 megs. To make a microwave oven at 27 megs, it would be, you know, one quarter of the size of my living room. It'd be a very inconvenient thing. But I don't have to do that. I can create enough E-field to excite the water molecules by putting those water molecules between two metal plates of a diathermy machine. And I've done that. And it works like a charm. And whether I'm putting a glass of water there or I'm putting my knee there, I'll get the same amount of heating per se, as long as I'm creating that amount of E-field. No matter what machine you use, you're trying to create a certain amount of volts per meter across the volume of the water. You do that in a cyclic manner at those frequencies we're talking about where it has the known loss tangent. You'll be coupling energy into the water, thermal energy into the water, which means the water molecules are now having a higher kinetic energy, which is translational speed of those molecules moving.
The problem that I have, in typical HHO, you have a bucket of water, you have two stainless steel pipes, and then you deliver 12 volts of DC, let's say. Later on, they have used the pulse width modulators with the square shape signals, and they were able to achieve much less current draw. But let's say you exciting with which higher and higher and higher voltage, and you're dealing with the gas that is being produced, dissolved from that liquid. Is that any moment in which it is simply impossible to increase the voltage? Back to you. Talking about distillated water.
I'm fairly sure that the HHO process and the microwave oven process and the diathermy machine are a different process. If with the diathermy machine or my microwave oven, I'm heating up a volume of water, and if I keep doing it, the water will eventually boil, and I'll be converting the water liquid into a vapor, a water vapor. But I haven't changed the chemical composition. I've only changed its state. I've gone from the liquid state to the gaseous state, and I've made water vapor. In the case of an HOH process, HHO process, you're doing something similar to electrolysis, and now you're pumping current through the water into those electrodes, and you're putting real electrodes into the fluid. In the case of the microwave oven, in the case of the diathermy machine, I am not touching the water with any metallic object. In the case of electrolysis, metallic object with voltage across the probes of the metallic object is now subjecting the water to a kind of current flow due to that voltage difference between those probes. And now, if you did it with one particular polarity, you'd be making oxygen at one probe and hydrogen at the other probe. You would be electrolyzing the water. You'd be doing an electrolysis process. And you're making a HOH gas. You're making hydrogen and oxygen gas, which is then a potentially explosive mixture. The microwave oven and the diathermy machine does not make a potentially explosive mixture. What comes out of that microwave oven, I could never light it with a match. What comes out of your HOH process, I think I could explode it with a match. Is that true, Wesley?
Yes, that is very much true, HHO. Yes, there is a major difference between these two techniques, because you have the electrolysis now. The distillated water is still not free from some minerals that helps water to split easier to the gaseous form, which would be two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen. Now, some people, they put baking soda or H and O, okay, and then The water is actually splitting faster. Let me jump. Now, when the more of the baking soda you put it, the more of the gas you're getting. So the people are able to make the better production of the gas. Now, it is not a secret that this gas is being used right now for the purpose of bonding metals together. It's working very good. Nobody uses argon any longer. So, the nature of my question was, which frequency would be the best to split using the pulse with modulation or pulse with square signal to react with the water molecules. But to
yeah, you're trying to make an electrolysis process, and I heard Ed in the background say you've got to add salt or some other solution to the water to get electrolysis. You've got to have a current flow to do electrolysis, and pure water is an extremely good insulator. Very few of us have water that pure, but pure water has 10 times higher dielectric strength than air. Air is good for 30,000 volts per centimeter. 3 million volts per meter is what air will sustain at standard temperature and pressure. Water is 10 times higher than that. 300 volts per centimeter. 30 million volts per meter is really pure water dielectric strength. So you put voltage between those two probes of truly pure water, you're not going to get any electrolysis. You get no action at all. You have to put some kind of ionizing substance in the water, whether it be baking soda, salt, sodium chloride, whatever. You have to put something in there to make the water conductive to get the electrolysis process working. You don't have to do that in a microwave oven. The microwave oven will heat your cup of water equally well, whether it's slightly salty water or whether it's completely pure water, because in either case, the dielectric constant and loss tangent of that water is very similar. Ain't that crazy? I know that Glenn wanted to make some more comments on all of this. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the points about dielectric constant in those areas, because they're all good, because at the higher volume level, that's, you know, really how this whole thermodynamic process is taking place. And what's interesting is that if you look at DC, you run a current through something, and, you know, you have Ohm's law, you're going to have power dissipated, and you're going to have temperature rise associated with that. But there's going to be a pattern at which that water will heat as you, you know, through conductivity. In other words, you're going to have a current through the water, a part of that water will heat up where the current is flowing, Ohm's law, power dissipation, and that, and then you'll have a certain amount of heating. Now, you can increase the frequency, and what there will all of a sudden start to be a different impedance through there and a different current flow, and you'll also see a different type of heating that takes place, but it'll be very, very similar to what's happening at DC. At 27 megahertz here again, you've got a coupling factor at which there will be a current flow through that water, a thermal raw at thermal temperature rise. But there is a difference here when you start getting up into microwave frequencies. When you get closer to the self-resonance of a material, any material that you have, even dielectrics, it doesn't even have to be water, you can reach a frequency where you can actually even heat a dielectric, because the molecular composition will start absorbing very, very evenly. I mean, like direct. That is not going to be the same effect as you're going to see at 27. Yes, you're going to have a heating effect because of the current flow, but in the microwave, narrow, you know, micron wavelengths, you're going to have a direct coupling that's going to be superior to anything at 27 megahertz or any other crazy frequency like that. And I don't know if you disagree with that, but I mean, as far as I know, that's how it works, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I don't agree.
Understood.
Resonance is a very sharp thing. What Glenn is describing is very broadband.
Glenn specifically said that the water is heating because current is flowing through it at 27 megacycles. I say absolutely not. I know that really pure water has a dielectric strength of 30 million volts per meter. That diathermy machine and those two plates aren't coming anywhere near that level of E-field. There is no breakdown of that water. I could put completely pure water between those two plates of the diathermy machine at 27 megs, and I will heat that water by loss tangent effect. The molecules are the dipole molecules trying to swing back and forth, and they do it with a phase delay. And I think I can explain the mechanism why there's a phase delay and why that is the mechanism of the heating that increases their velocity, which you and I call temperature. There is no current flow per se of a normal nature that you could probe. I could put two probes into that water that it's pure enough, and I'm putting the normal E-field voltage that the diathermy machine is putting. Let's assume the diathermy machine is creating a 1,000 volts per meter. And I put 1,000 volts across these two probes that are a meter apart. And if the water is pure enough, no current will flow. But in an E-field of 1,000 volts per meter in a diathermy machine, I will heat that water. It's not current flow. It's loss tangent. Now back to you, Glenn.
The bodily fluids, which are very conductive because of all the salt.
Agreed, but I can heat up a glass of water in a diathermy machine, and I've done it. I'll admit I didn't make sure it was super pure water. Over to you, Glenn.
Dick, I'm on the HT. I'll have to get back to you in a couple of minutes when I'm inside.
Okay, Ed, you seem to have some opinion on this. What do you think is taking place here, Ed, with the heating effect that takes place in a microwave oven? There's a zillion people out there that are positive that 24 or 50 megacycles, which is the exact frequency a microwave oven must work at to be in the ISM band, the license-free band. That's just strictly a frequency left over. Nothing magic about that frequency. It's a convenient frequency where you can develop lots of power in the available magnetrons. It's a convenient size for the oven, big enough for a chicken, and you can create a nice sealed cavity and bounce the radio waves in there or whatever. But the original microwave oven worked at another frequency, and it's not that different from a diathermy machine. I wonder if you agree or disagree with that, Ed. EAV, K2RIW.
WV2EAD. In general terms, I agree, with one exception. My analysis and studies have shown that a Hebrew National hot dog is resonant at exactly 2450 megahertz, and they will heat up faster than all the competition. That's why they're so expensive.
Are you telling me that any other brand of kosher hot dog doesn't heat as fast?
Well, you have to understand, a Hebrew National hot dog, a higher authority here.
You do realize that was a joke, Dick.
If I bought a Glatt kosher hot dog, would it heat any faster in my microwave oven?
Wait.
Why the oven?
Definitely.
Okay, I know that you were having some trouble with some of these concepts before, Barry. What part was bothering you the most?
I was laboring under the contention that the frequency was important, that if you, that the, I guess you, I was wrong, I think. I'm still not sure, but you're telling me if I lined the walls of this room, if it's a bigger room, you know, that would fit a 10-meter wavelength in it nice and comfortably, if I did that with aluminum foil and put a dipole in here and started to transmit 1 kW, I would cook myself. That's what you're telling me.
QSLOM.
I agree. That's what I'm telling you. What part of that do you not believe? I mean, if you believe in conservation of energy, Barry, let's look at it from that point of view. You're pouring a kilowatt into that 10-meter dipole that's in that room. And because the room is conductive, which is equivalent to putting a dipole or a feed horn inside of a screen room, and I've done that, and it's a devil of a problem to re-impedance match that antenna when it's in a conductive screen room with the door closed. But once you you succeed at doing that, you've finally done the impedance match of that antenna in that room, and you're pouring 1,000 watts of RF energy into that room, and assuming the tinfoil, let's make it the copper screening, multiple layers of copper screening on all of the walls in the room, so that no energy can get out of the room, and you're pouring 1,000 watts continuously into the room. You're putting 1,000 joules per second of energy into that room, and it's got nowhere to go. Nothing in the room is lossy other than the human being. The walls are made out of copper, they're lossless. The antenna is made out of copper, it's lossless. The antenna is impedance matched, and energy is going in. Joules are going into the room. It's bouncing around in the room. The only lossy object in the room, dielectrically speaking, lost tangent, is the human being, named Barry. Every single one of those kilowatts is going to go into some portion of Barry, because by conservation of energy, there's nowhere else it could go. Please don't do that. Over to you, Barry.
AC2QAQ, I'm back.
Barry first. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, I'm going to have to accept that. That's where I was having a problem. So I guess you're right. Just one little question. If I leave the room, what happens to the RF?
When you leave the room and you shut the door, assuming the room is perfectly conductive, by definition, the impedance match of the antenna will go to 0 ohms. I cannot impedance match that antenna anymore if there's nothing lossy in the room. The energy in the room bounces around. It's got nowhere to go except back into that antenna. By definition, the standing wave ratio of the antenna will become infinity. The apparent number of ohms of the antenna will go to 0 ohms. Been there, done that. If there ain't lossy stuff in the room, you can't pump energy into the room. I can't pump energy into a closed-circuited piece of waveguide. It'll all reflect back to me. That room is a very large equivalent of a piece of waveguide. Over to you, Barry.
I see it more as it's the same as taking an axe to the coax to your antenna. What happens to the transmitter then?
Okay, it makes sense. All right. So what you're saying is frequency doesn't matter. You're sure of that. Is there a point where frequency might matter? You keep going up in frequency. Do you run into a problem, or is it this equation is going to go wherever you go?
It depends on your definition now. If I keep the cavity, the room, perfectly lossless, and if the only lossy object in the room is the piece of biological material or the glass of water, every single joule of energy that I manage to couple into that room, because I've impedance matched that antenna, which is equivalent to the probe that's out of your microwave oven, out of that magnetron is a probe that's acting as a quarter wave ground plane antenna into your microwave oven. And it's launching a signal, quasi omnidirectional signal. Doesn't matter what the pattern is, it gets bounced all over in there. As long as I manage to couple some number of joules, watts per second, whatever, into that cavity, and the only lossy object in there is the water or biological material, it must absorb all of it. It has no choice. Now, as I go to higher and higher frequencies, and the von Hippel book will tell you what is the loss tangent of water as you go to very high frequencies, I think it starts going back down again, obvious by the fact that water at optical frequencies is transparent. I believe that water has a very low loss tangent. It's got a certain, refractive index, which is really the equivalent of dielectric constant. It's got a refractive index at optical frequencies, but I think its loss tangent becomes very low. In other words, the amount of bounces of the energy in the microwave oven is going to go to a higher and higher number of bounces required for the water to finally absorb it as I go to a higher frequency. So coupling energy into the water, when I go to a high enough frequency where the water is quasi-lossless in loss tangent, it becomes more difficult to do the process. I don't know who wants to talk about this one. K2RIW.
EC2QIQ.
You with a comment?
Okay, QIQ and then BDH in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
You're definitely right. I mean, about
you know, dielectric constant and on materials and other things. But I think there's something else here that we're kind of like overlooking here a little bit, and that's the point that if you have microwave, let's say you have a microwave transmitter or extremely broadband transmitter, let's say, and it can handle very, very high VSWR, as the frequency goes up, the absorption rate is going to be a little bit different with different materials. For an example, if you were to have a 30 megahertz transmitter that can handle a very good VSWR, and you, you know, take a peek at, you know, down a, an open cable with your eye, chances are you're not going to damage your eye. You do that in microwave frequencies, your eye's going to cook and you could go blind. There's other situations where with frequency in dielectrics, at certain dielectrics in microwave, certain microwave frequencies, they'll just sit there and do nothing. And then you increase to a, to the right frequency, and all of a sudden that dielectric's going to start heating up. Echo-absorbed materials, at certain frequencies, they'll heat up because they'll start absorbing like, you know, but here again, different materials will absorb better at certain frequencies. I think you have to agree with that, that K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
The eye thing is a problem of scale.
But what about frequency on that?
Hold on now. The absorption of materials at different frequencies, is it any different than the documented loss tangent of that material at that frequency? Is there any difference between the rate of loss for a known E field versus loss tangent? And loss tangent of all the materials you care about have been reasonably well documented. Is there an error in that? Is that what you're saying, Glenn? Go ahead.
No, not at all, Dick. I think that that's right on the money. What we're saying, though, but that is frequency dependent.
I wouldn't call that frequency dependent in the normal manner. If I talk about my dipole being frequency dependent, and I made it 132 feet long, it's got a very sharp resonance at around 3.7 megacycles, very frequency dependent, and I go 300 kc above or below that, and all hell breaks loose. It goes from a 72 ohm load to a 1,000 ohm load, very frequency sensitive. The loss tangent of the materials you and I are talking about are nothing like that. I have to go multiple octaves or multiple decades in frequency before I see a substantial change in loss tangent of most materials until I get near the infrared or optical frequencies where some funny things start happening. And yes, you've got kinds of resonance up there, but at all the RF frequencies you and I care about, the change in loss tangent with frequency is a very slow, nearly continuous curve. No real resonance like that dipole. I wonder if you agree or disagree with that one, Glenn.
Completely agree with that, Dick, and in fact, I didn't think that there was a disagreement there. I think what we were talking about is that when you get into those higher frequencies, you know, getting closer to the light spectrum, that there is an absorption that takes place in those areas at the molecular level that definitely starts peaking up quite a bit. I think, do you agree with that?
Absolutely, I agree with that. But my oven, my convection oven in my kitchen does not do that. That's what started this all off. You were trying to convince me that my convection oven in my kitchen is exciting the individual molecules in such a way that the outer orbits of those electrons hop to a larger diameter. And I say, no way in hell. My convection oven cannot do that. And you and I think still have a degree of disagreement on that one. Over to you, Glenn.
Hold on a second, Dick. Okay. I think there's something else that we're not thinking about here. RF at very high frequencies won't penetrate that chicken, but the RF at low frequencies will penetrate it very nicely, and that might be where we're thinking that this isn't working well at the higher frequencies.
Okay. At what frequency do you think the RF stops penetrating your chicken?
I only stops. I think that it doesn't penetrate as well. I think that it winds up being absorbed in the beginning of the chicken and doesn't get down to the middle as you go higher in frequency.
Okay, you're right on that one. When you look at the radio frequency biohazard curves, when you look at the ANSI report, American National Standard Institute, C95 report, this biohazard report, they talk about the skin depth of penetration of various frequencies. And what makes the so-called microwave frequencies so much safer to a human being is that above 1.5 gigs, you only get a couple of centimeters of penetration, portion of, I think it's only a centimeter of penetration, and the impedance of a human being above 1.5 gigahertz, 80% of the energy reflects, only 20% penetrates. So you have a poor impedance match above 1.5 gigs. Now you're about to say, what about my chicken being cooked at 2.5 gigs, 2.45 gigs? Does it matter that it's only 20% absorbed on the first bounce? The energy in that microwave oven has no other place to go. If it has to bounce across those walls 20 times before the chicken finally absorbs it, the chicken will absorb it by conservation of energy and has nowhere else to go. I know that Mr. BDH, give me the full call letters, number, I'm going to guess WB2BDH, correct your call letters, sir. Please tell me your name and then your question or comment on all of the above. K2RIW TechNet, my name is Dick.
Don't forget me, Dick, KC2QIQ.
Okay, fine. This is Dick. Call is WA2 Victor David Henry. Name is John. Only comment I wanted to make is that I have heard that there is an absorption or a vibrational mode of the water molecule somewhere in the 1 to 2 gigahertz range, because I've heard them speak of the so-called water hole, which was a potential frequency for deep space or extraterrestrial communication. Because the water molecule absorbed very heavily right around this frequency, the so-called water hole frequency. And I believe it is somewhere in the 1 to 2 gigahertz range that the water molecule has this vibrational mode that is heavily absorbed upon that. I wonder if you could comment on that.
He's talking about the hydrogen hole, Dick.
When it comes to SETI search, search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and when it comes to radio astronomy type searches, there is the so-called water hole between roughly 1 and 10 gigs. That is the so-called very quiet region. The Deep Space Network of NASA shows 2.3 gigahertz as the main frequency of operation of, say, for instance, Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, and many other spacecraft. Apollo, I personally listened to the Apollo 15 and 16 spacecraft at 2287.5 megacycles, roughly 2.3 gigs, chosen by NASA for the Deep Space Network because it's a very quiet frequency. It's very quiet because it's high enough where you're not getting ionospheric effects. It's low enough where you can still get good noise figure out of the front end you can use. And you start getting water vapor absorption at around 15 gigahertz and up to 22 gigahertz is where it's the worst. So the water vapor becomes a non-transparent material. The water vapor in our atmosphere is a non-transparent material at roughly 22 gigahertz. So you don't want to go that high. You don't want to go lower than roughly a gigahertz because you start getting ionospheric effects. So the so-called watering hole, they call it, which started off with the single hydrogen element, 1420 megacycles, was one of the places where they started the search. So you can find the hydrogen, the free hydrogen molecules in the universe by listening to 1420. So they chose that frequency region simply because it's quiet. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, I just want to take a step back in talking about, you know, just thermal dynamics and, you know, how is it that basically you have, you know, thermal transfer in things and what's actually happening at the molecular level. And in other words, if you have a piece of copper and it's at one temperature range and you have another piece of copper at a different, let's say at a lower temperature range, and you bring the two together, and now the heat is going to transfer from one plate into the other. Now you got the delta. Now, the copper on one side is having an effect on in trying to raise the temperature until they reach equilibrium at that point, and that heat and that energy is going to transfer. Well, the copper molecules aren't going back and forth between one plate to the other, but the energy is transferring. And it's not an electromagnetic wave that it's taking place at, but what you are doing is you are getting a coupling of an energy from one plate to the other. Do you agree with me so far on that one?
Absolutely. And tell me, what is the mechanism of the transfer of the energy?
Well, here again, this has got to, in other words, in order to see the energy
go from one from one area to another, you have to look at the electron level state and look at what it is so that the energy can transfer. So basically those internally, the that atom is going to be at a certain energy state at temperature, and when the other plate is at a different energy state. So you will see an electron movement. Do you agree with that?
Until we define our terms, I'm not sure. I've got two copper bars on the table in front of me right now in this theoretical experiment. I've got two copper bars. Before you entered the room, one of them I heated up with my blowtorch, and it's at 50 degrees C. The other one, I left it alone, it's at 25 degrees C. Assume you've got a super good microscope or any other kind of theoretical instrumentation. And without using a thermometer, without touching these, you use your instrumentation to look at the molecular level at the 25 degrees C copper and the 50 degrees C copper. If you've got good enough instrumentation, tell me what difference you're going to see. Don't tell me one's got more energy than the other. That's a given. Tell me what your instrumentation at the molecular level is going to see. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, what I would imagine I would see is if I look at the lower temperature copper, those electrons are going, and around those molecules of copper inside there, those atoms of copper are going to be at one energy state. They're going to be at one level. And if I look at the other one, I'm going to see basically copper atoms at a higher energy state. Does that answer your question?
It tells me what your thinking is, and I strongly disagree with it. With the instrumentation that's able to look at your copper molecules that are locked in position as far as the matrix is concerned, because it's a solid. These are not liquid. It's a solid material. So in general, each individual copper atom is going to stay relatively fixed in position. I'm now allowing you to measure the diameter of the outer level of electrons in the 25 degree C copper and the 50 degree C copper. I'm measuring the diameter of the outer level of electrons. What difference will I see?
I would see an exchange between each individual copper atom where basically one valent electron would be being kicked off into the next copper atom, and they would be transferring these electrons back and forth internally at the molecular level. And that movement, electron interreaction between one copper atom to the next copper atom, is going to be moving very, very quickly and violently at a higher temperature. Now, if I look at the cooler plate, the electron levels between moving from higher to lower states in the next one to it is going to be, and it's all balanced because it's actually electrically neutral at this point, because there's no current flow in either plate. It's just thermal energy. And when I put those two plates together, what's going to happen is now the heated copper is going to start transferring that energy by the amount of interreactions between its valent energy shells will start to transfer into the cooler plate.
To a degree, I agree with you, but for a different reason. In the case of a fluid, and a gas is called a fluid, and liquids are called fluid, but if I talk about gaseous molecules like O2 and N2 and H2, when I heat them up, they translate more rapidly. They move through space. They move at either 500 meters per second at room temperature or at higher temperature. They move translationally a little faster. In the case of a solid, temperature is again average kinetic energy of every one of those atoms or molecules. They are shaking back and forth in place. They are locked generally in position, but not
for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
They are locked in place as far as each copper atom has a general address where he's going to be at. But he is rocking back and forth. He is vibrating in position. The hotter ones are vibrating more rapidly. temperature